Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Locke.
Welcome to Serotalk Podcast 16. This is Michael Loff.
I'm Ricky Inger. Wow, we're on podcast Sweet 16. How cool is that?
That's right. You gotta love it. 16 was good then, and it's good now. WWDC taking place, and very exciting news about the iPhone 3GS.
Nothing else has been talked about since this announcement on Twitter. And what, you might ask, is the big announcement with the iPhone 3GS?
Well, among other things, you're going to have the voice-over screen reader that people are accustomed to with the Macintosh built into this, so you will be able to take your finger and navigate the phone. You put your finger in the top left, whatever function is in the top left is what you get. Gesture-based, so that might be something for folks to get used to.
When you talk about a touch screen, you know, that's a very visual interface. And so this is definitely going to be something to get used to.
You tap something to hear what it does, and then you double tap it to activate.
Right.
So that way you don't accidentally do something you didn't intend to.
Exactly.
And you can use your left and right keys to move forward and back by items. And it's just people getting used to just a touch and this concept of flicking to navigate and manipulate items on the screen.
So this is interesting, giving people an idea of where things are actually located. The interface, whenever voiceover is enabled, is slightly different than if you were a sighted person.
And some other cool things here, not only is it going to be available in 21 languages, but folks will be able to install it themselves as long as you have the latest iTunes 8.2 on either the Windows or, of course, the Macintosh. You'll have no problem. In Windows, of course, they're mentioning Window Eyes, and I'm sure System Access will be up to speed there. That's a safe bet. But the other thing that people got to keep in mind here are the prices. And so it's going to be interesting to see how many people jump on board. You get the branded, of course, which is tied to AT&T. You can get the 16-gig phone for $199 or the 32-gig phone for $299. But the process of doing that, based on what my son had, it looks like you're spending about $109 a month because they're going to try to get you on that $59 voice plan, $20 for texting, and $30 for data, 3G. So there's about $109 a month plus a little bit of tax. So if you want the items unlocked, then you're paying $499 for an 8 gig, $599 for a 16 gig, or $699 for 32.
Wow. That's
so 32 the question is, will people do that? And, you know, how much money will they spend? Will they go to save the money on the phone, but ultimately pay over a 2-year commitment? Or will people the phone unlocked? And what will they be able to do if they take it into T-Mobile?
I want to see it in action before I do this, but I'm excited that Apple has done this regardless of whether I get the phone myself or not. It's a choice that we have needed for quite some time. The iPhone is by far the most popular phone in the mainstream.
Well, it's the most versatile phone. I mean, you can do, I watch people use it. They can do things that we cannot do to this day, whether it be Pandora, native GPS that they don't have to pay extra for. I'll be curious. See, that's what I mean. I'm like you. I want a little bit of a wait and see, but our plan is definitely to have one to demo to you on our next podcast. This is the future. If you're afraid of touch screens, we better get used to it because some people feel they're going to go away. I don't believe so. Less moving parts, the aesthetics of it. Touch screens are going to be a part of life.
I don't think they're going away anytime soon. Whether we're on our way from the current generation of touch screens to something else that we haven't even imagined yet, at least for the next little while, they're only going to become more, not less popular.
So I'm cautiously optimistic. I can't wait to see the thing in action. I know I won't be one of the first adopters.
Way to go for giving us the choice to purchase this.
What will I do with that N82?
It's obsolete as soon as you get it out of the box.
Kudos to Apple. This is exciting news. One other thing on the Mac front, those using Macintoshes, it looks like while it will be September before the new Snow Leopard comes out, the price is only going to be $29 to upgrade, not $300.
As it will be for Windows 7?
Yeah, so drop a zero.
Going back to the iPhone, this is a first generation, and there may be some kinks to be worked out, but I think it's absolutely a step in the right direction.
You can definitely count on Serotalk staying on top of this, giving you the latest information. We encourage you to go, if you haven't, bookmark the Serotalk.com blog, because we will have other posts. Check the socializer. We will have other news as it becomes available. There's already people wanting to form a roundtable to discuss this. So certainly we get a group of owners, people have this thing in their hand, we will certainly be doing a tech chat or podcast somehow letting you know the latest and greatest in access technology and what Apple's bringing to the table.
Absolutely. And we've talked a lot about Apple today, but that's not all we have to talk about. We've got lots more interesting stuff.
We're going to announce the winners of Blue Snowflake and Icicle contest. We got some great entries, and we're going to be playing those for you as well. And later on, we're going to do an interview with Steve Sockson of the AT Show.
If you've never checked out his show, you should definitely begin to do that. Sometimes there are specific topics under discussion, and sometimes it's a group of people who are getting together to ask questions about technology in general, and everything from cell phones to MSN. You almost never know what's going to come up on the AT Show, but Steve himself is a wonderful host and very knowledgeable about lots of things.
That's right, and it's similar to our tech chat, only they use Ventrilo, so you can participate, and he goes for 2 hours, and they do that Wednesday from 7 to 9, and all that information is available, and you can go to our show notes or drop over to ATMaine, as in the state, ATMAINE.com, and check that out. And Steve is a guru on the Macintosh, so you have a question about the Mac, he is the man to ask, and we'll be talking about that a little later as well. First, welcome all the new folks who are listening to the podcast via the Tech Podcast Network, known as TPN, at techpodcast.com, and encourage all of our existing listeners, if you are into technology, to go over and check out, I think there's almost 50 podcasts over there. So if you want to stay up on technology, a lot of good stuff over there, Windows, Mac, IT, whatever you're interested in. I guess, well, we'll get right to the fun here at the contest. People have been waiting for. We issued this 4 weeks ago, a challenge for you to win either the Blue Snowflake little portable microphone that you can take with you, great for your netbook or notebook, or just something small you can hold in your hand, and the Icicle, which is a cool little adapter to take your existing XLR microphone and plug it into your PC and make it sound really, really good.
Both of these made by a company called Blue, and we hope you haven't been holding your breath for 4 weeks to find out if you won or not, because if you did, you may be Blue at this point also.
Or maybe they'll be Blue that they didn't win.
That is possible.
Well, we got all kinds of entries. We've got everyone doing Elvis to basic emails saying that my microphone sounds like garbage.
Yeah, and a couple that amply demonstrate that their microphone does indeed sound like garbage. And we've had people singing and rapping and coming up with all sorts of poetry. Nobody did a limerick.
I was hoping for a limerick. They would have definitely had a good shot, unless they really screwed it up, because I love limericks. Ricky and I are both suckers for limericks, so you would have had a good shot on that.
There will be other contests. For the Snowflake, one of the really good entries that we had was done by an individual that we shall call Big Wally. He sent in this composition that we really thoroughly enjoyed.
I need a new mic for my computer, because I do not have one. If I had a computer mic, I could talk on Skype all night. I need a new computer microphone because I don't have one.
And on the Blue Icicle, we got this very nice poem, although one of the references, I have no idea what she's talking about.
Ms. Mary Ellen Earls sent us this.
What the heck? Get Connect. This is why I love Serotech. Email, shopping, what a whirl. The world's my oyster. What a pearl. What the heck? Get Connect. This is why I love Serotech. Radio, podcasts in my hand. Movies on demand. What the heck? Get Connect. This is why I love Serotech. Text chat, voice chat. Now think of that. I'd rather do this than spoil a brat. What the heck? Get Connect. Connect. This is why I love Serotech.
All right, I feel like I'm on the Emmy Awards. And the envelope, please. I have one right here. Open it up.
Uh-huh.
Who won?
Who is it? Ah. Drum roll, please.
Snowflake. And here...
And the winner is...
Before we tell you the name, listen to this.
I'm dreaming of a snowflake, Mike. Just like the one I've never seen. So I can sound great. Talking on the chat and singing for you all to. I'm dreaming of a snowflake, Mike, so I can be my best for you. 'Cause the money's not there to buy one fair. And I'd like to have something new.
All right. Congratulations.
Wasn't that awesome?
Yeah.
Lovely.
Jennifer Perdue.
Congratulations, Jennifer.
That's right. She put her heart and soul into that.
That she did. And we'll be looking forward to hearing her on her new blue snowflake. Congratulations again, Jennifer.
All right. And now for the grand prize winner of the icicle. Take a listen to this.
The temperature is rising. I may melt by end of day. Unless you send that icicle to San Diego right away. You murdered SMAs. They were such an expensive pest. For that, I'll sing your praises. Serotech's the best. You freed me from the jaws of frequent swindles vexation. I even come to Serotech when I need relaxation. Samnet has great movies. Some favorite books are there. But best of all are the people who help each other and care. Remember the computers that wouldn't talk to me? They're essaying with the help of Paul. I love this accessibility. I've emailed all my friends. I've told every geek I know. Serotech's the best! For access, it's the place to go.
What do you think, Ricky?
Very nicely done. I love poetry and kind of writing cute little things like that, and this one definitely fit the bill. Very nicely done.
Lena Hinkle.
Lena Hinkle, yes. The Blue Icicle.
By the way, speaking of Lena, she will be coming into our tech chat on June 18th to demo her new advanced NLS player. So if you want to learn how those things work, because it's going to be a few months before many people can get their hands on them. They're going to the veterans first.
You can certainly get a sneak preview of what it's like. We've heard the Friday morning podcast. Bill Bullis did a review of this. He did both the basic and the advanced player review.
Kind of grabbed it from the guy and went in the other room and had like 5 minutes to record it and never saw it before.
So Lena may provide a perspective of someone who's had it for a little longer and been able to play with it and find out all its idiosyncrasies and all the things that it really does well. So we're looking forward to that.
As we have done and continue to do on Serotalk, almost every podcast, we feature another great AT-based podcast that covers different issues, maybe takes a different approach to it. And here's one, definitely. It's Steve Sockson's great AT Main podcast that's held every Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 Eastern. Steve, thanks for taking a few minutes to join us today.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, this is interesting the way you do this. You actually integrate it into a Ventrilo chat. For those who don't know, Ventrilo is another great program for voice communications. From doing a tech chat, I know that presents some interesting challenges to actually have that kind of interaction where people are allowed to put in their two cents and you have all different mic levels and quality of microphones.
A huge problem is the microphone levels, and some people are really, really quiet, and then you get the next person that's super loud, and they just, oh, it's very tough live. I try to level it all out in the podcast before that goes out. But during the actual show, that's posed quite a challenge. And the other one is just people coming in with questions from all different skill levels and on all sorts of things. And there's always someone that picks the one question that I think to myself, I hope no one asks me about this. It's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it. And I especially like the fact that people talk to one another. It's not about listening to me blabber on and on about this, that, or the other thing. But someone might ask a question about, geez, you know, what's a good accessible antivirus program? And someone else on the show will answer, oh, well, I'm using this. And then someone might say, well, I tried that, but I found this works better. And I can throw my two cents in or sit back and listen and play more of the role of a moderator. And in that respect, I probably get as much out of the show as any listener.
Who is Steve Socks?
I'm blind from birth and have used technology since the third grade when I had a brand new shiny Apple IIe, which was my first portable computer. It was mounted on one of those rolling TV carts. Your younger listeners probably don't even know what those are anymore. I used to wheel that thing down the hall and get to my various classrooms and plug it in. I love technology. For me, it was a great equalizer. I could do all kinds of stuff with technology that I couldn't do without it. I went to a really rural school, and so being able to get stuff into Braille and that sort of thing was fantastic. Being able to do that without being dependent on someone else to do that. Anyway, I went through school and I went to Germany as an exchange student when I was 16. And one of the first things that struck me was I was the only one that had technology. Everyone else in the school for the blind where I had to go was using a brailler or a slate, but there was really little technology available to students. And what was there was very antiquated. And I thought, geez, I'm really fortunate that I have this stuff. I really should not take it for granted. So when I got back, I went through college here and moved in with my then fiance, who I met while at college, and I moved here to Maine and was waiting for my phone to ring. I was hoping to do some networking stuff, telecommunications networking stuff. And of course, you can't just move into a new state and put out a shingle and expect that your phone's going to ring right away. So I was waiting for this to happen, and it didn't. And a friend of mine called and said he'd gotten a job. He needed help getting the system adapted for use with speech. And the state agency here in Maine wasn't going to get to it for another 5 weeks. And his unemployment was running out. His employer was frustrated because he couldn't start work, and they had this guy hired that they, you know, couldn't get any work out of yet. And it was just a mess. And so he asked if I would help him out. And I said, sure, for a six pack and a pizza, I'd be more than happy to help him out. And I did. And one thing led to another. And I wound up getting into the assistive tech field, which has been fantastic. It's been my way to give back to folks that have really given me so much over the years. But also just because I've seen what a difference technology has made in my life and in the lives of others, that it can make a huge difference. So now I live in Maine and I provide training support services to, well, at the risk of sounding desperate, just about anyone, schools, organizations in the private sector, state organization, and individuals. And I'm really focusing lately on individuals because a lot of trainers tend to gravitate toward getting clients from Division for the Blind or Voc Rehab or whatever the state agency may be. And that's great, but it's a lot of paperwork too. And what I found is that oftentimes there are people who want to learn how to do something that they can't get the Division for the Blind to pay for, how to shop on eBay or how to work with a particular web page and that sort of stuff. So I've been providing a lot of training directly to individuals and, of course, using Serotech's awesome remote access solutions, which make it all possible. My show started by accident, but Maine is a very geographically diverse state, and public transportation is virtually non-existent. And I worked for an agency here in Maine that purchased iVocalize, which is an older chat system. It's still in existence, albeit less accessible now. I used that technology to form what at the time was just a virtual computer users group, and it was, frankly, a group of folks that I was working with or had worked with. And the idea was to network and get some folks that were very isolated or were feeling rather isolated to be able to communicate with one another. And I never advertised it, but one person told someone else out of state, and that person told someone else. And it's funny because the first time I saw my show mentioned on a mailing list, it wasn't me who put it there. So it's kind of grown from there, and now we have folks that come in from all over the world or participate, you know, from the podcast all over the world. So it's grown into something that I think is great, especially for folks who are just getting started, beginner to intermediate, or people that just want to bounce ideas off of people. I got an email from someone who listens to me as she commutes to and from work in Montana. She forthrightly said that she doesn't listen to the show because of me, but because of the other opinions that are mentioned on the show from other users that are doing stuff day to day. And that's great. I mean, whatever people can get out of the show is fantastic. So
now you become a really strong advocate of the Macintosh. And I'm curious, does this go all the way back to your Apple IIe days, or where did this passion come into play?
I felt very abandoned by Apple. Apple used to be very accessible back in the old 2E days. And then when the Mac came out, there was some token accessibility initially, and it kind of went by the wayside. Then there was a product called Outspoken, which existed, but they received very, very little support from Apple, which is very unfortunate. And I felt very betrayed, frankly, because they had made such a big deal about being accessible and so forth. And it came to pass that in Maine, our former governor passed legislation that would get a laptop for every 7th and 8th grade public high school student. He wanted to do this virtual network sort of thing where people could e-learn and collaborate. Every kid in 7th and 8th grade public school would be issued their very own laptop. And of course, this went out to bid. And one of the first organizations to bid on this massive project was none other than Apple. And they, of course, by reputation, are already in many schools and so forth. And so I immediately started protesting because they had no accessibility at the time, no plans to make things accessible. And my thought was, you know, this is a great opportunity, especially for blind kids, to really be integrated into the school system. If everything's going to be electronic anyway, that's great. But they were talking about using a lot of proprietary Apple stuff. And so although the argument was made that, you know, well, give the blind kids a PC, my thought was this is too good an opportunity to pass up. So I started arguing and fighting to not let Apple be even allowed to bid on this contract because they didn't meet the definitions as set forth for accessibility, and really just made me very passionate about it. I don't mean to imply that Apple did this because of Maine by any means. North Carolina was also doing some stuff, I believe, at the same time. But Apple made mention of this new screen reader that they were going to be creating, and that eventually became VoiceOver. I was still very pessimistic because my thought was that they were going to come up with some token solution, put it in the operating system and say, well, we did it. We're done. We've met the requirements as stated here in the state's contract, which were pretty vague, to be honest. And that would be that. They would drop it. So VoiceOver came out in 10.4, and I saw it as something that was great, but I didn't hold out much hope. And it wasn't really until Leopard came out that I thought, you know, they really do seem to be committed to making things accessible, to really doing this. But it took them until Leopard to really sort of convince me. I guess I'm a bit pessimistic by nature, but they did. I like the fact that it's built in to the operating system. People make the comparison to other screen readers all the time, which I understand, but Apple, I think, is the new kid on the block where a lot of this is concerned. And although one can argue, and I would be one of the first to argue, that they should have started much earlier, the reality is that given the time they've had, they've made up a lot of ground and they don't show any signs of flagging. There's been unofficial rumors about what might or might not be coming up in their new to be released operating system, nicknamed Snow Leopard. And they've also made the accessible iPod Nano and the accessible Shuffle, and they've worked to make iTunes accessible. So they seem to be, more than making an effort to accessibility, they really seem to be committed to it, the exception being the iPhone and the iPod Touch. That's kind of what got me passionate about this whole thing. A state that purchased 40,000 of these laptops, and I thought blind kids shouldn't be locked out of that. That's really where this came from. I remember one particular meeting I had gone to, and there was a high-up official in the special education department here in Maine. And the question was asked, well, how many blind kids are we talking about here? And I made the comment that, you know, geez, I didn't realize No Child Left Behind excluded any blind kids. And that was the end of the meeting, but it woke me up real quick to, I guess, the mentality of this. And I thought, geez, I have to be passionate about this one way or the other. So it's kind of ironic. At first, I was very passionate against it. And now it's kind of flipped around and I'm, I guess, an Apple advocate.
A totally blind person like myself can pull an iMac out of the box, turn it on, hook up a Braille display, have Braille right away, have speech right away, have instructions to actually get it configured and usable, can get it backed up, and also have a coexisting Windows install. So if I need to do some things in Windows as well as the Mac, they certainly deserve some accolades for making a very accessible whole operating system from start to finish.
I went to a presentation one time, and I have the MacBook Air, which is a nice laptop, but it uses some silly video adapter. If you don't have that adapter, you can't plug it into a projector, and I was supposed to do this presentation. and I didn't have the stupid adapter. So I immediately panicked until I realized that I'm in a whole room of people with Macs. I just need someone to give me their laptop for a minute. And I found such a person, fortunately for me, but was able to turn on VoiceOver immediately and have access without installing anything. I had to configure the speed. It was the only configuration change I had to make. And I thought, this is incredible that I can walk up to almost any Mac at this point and use it without installing or changing anything or changing the environment at all for the person who was using it before I took it over.
Many people are having great success asking authors of software if they can make their software a little more accessible. And of course, they have the same tool that we do.
I initially was very skeptical because no scripting language existed in VoiceOver. And my thought was that there's no way to make any sort of modifications to make applications work. And Apple said, well, you know, authors have to design applications correctly. And if they do, they're going to work fine. And I thought, well, that's a heck of a thing to ask for developers to go back and change their applications just because, you know, we at Apple think you should. And I thought this isn't going to happen. And I came to realize that, in fact, it is happening. Apple uses, well, many languages work on Apple, but Cocoa is a real popular one that most Mac developers are using anyway. And the accessibility hooks are there, meaning that if an application is correctly written in Cocoa and adheres to the Cocoa standards, more likely than not, it will work and do so in a way that doesn't require any sort of scripting and so forth. And Apple also has resources available for developers who want to make their applications accessible but don't know how. There are people at Apple that, free of charge, a developer can meet, sit down with, and hammer out, you know, the technical stuff. And a Apple engineer will look at their code or consult with them on that sort of techie level and say, this is what you need to do to make this accessible. And that's a free service. You just have to get there. That's a huge thing as well, because developers oftentimes aren't opposed to making things work better and more accessibly. They just don't know how to do it, and they don't have the time to do all the research to figure it out. So it is nice to say, just go here, or, you know, point them to the Apple website where accessibility-related resources are. It's amazing how many Macintosh applications work and how many are easily fixable or have been easily fixed.
So, Steve, what are your thoughts on social networking as a form to help us become not only more alert and aware of the latest technologies, but also social issues and giving us the ability to interact and make a change?
I think it's fantastic. Twitter, for example, and these other social networking sites, the way that information is freely exchanged is a blessing and a curse, I think. But in terms of accessibility and issues and that sort of stuff, it's great because you can really start a wave of groundswell support for something or against something. We saw this recently with the Amazon Kindle project and the Authors Guild's opposition to text-to-speech and so forth. And I realize it's still not perfect, but I would say in large part because of social networking and reaching out through that, there was a lot more people that got involved than otherwise would have. What's really nice also is that it can be a discussion. So I may put something out there, or, you know, might be a view or an experience or whatever, and someone else disagrees with that. And some third person may read that and may chime in, and that's okay, because even if people disagree, I think it's often very, very important to look at different points of view, and their points of view that I may not otherwise have considered, or maybe that they haven't otherwise considered. And I think oftentimes people walk away from these discussions thinking, never thought about it that way. It's funny though, because social networking, another one of those things I thought was just silly when I first looked at Twitter and I saw things like having a cup of coffee, and someone else would tweet getting ready to go to lunch. I thought, you know, who has time for this? But it's just gotten huge, and I've realized that it has almost become essential at this point for getting information. A lot of companies are connected to Twitter, so they will broadcast. As soon as there's an update, it's broadcasted on Twitter. News outlets are on Twitter and so forth. And so if you monitor social networking, you can stay pretty current without having to go all over the place to try to be current. So I find, although it can be distracting, it's also in many respects helped me to become more efficient.
You know, if you're seeing irrelevant posts, then you're just not following the right people. I mean, that's the whole art to it as well. Having tools to search it, to harvest the information that's available there.
The other thing is that initially I felt guilty if I followed someone and I thought, geez, I don't want to unfollow this person. I mean, you know, what if they look at their follower list and see I'm not on it anymore? And then I looked and I saw that, you know, people were unfollowing me. And I thought, people aren't worried about this. Why should I? And the more I thought about it, if you follow someone, it's because you find what they're doing at the moment of interest. That doesn't mean you always find it of interest, but at the moment you do. That's how I kind of view Twitter. If I watch a show on CBS, I'm tuned into CBS, but that doesn't mean I'm never going to change my channel. As soon as CBS switches over to something I don't care about, I may change my channel. If I'm listening to a radio station and it plays a song I don't like, I'm going to change it. And I look at the Twitter sphere kind of in that same respect. People will often follow me if I'm talking about a topic of interest. And then if I'm talking about, you know, what I'm doing with my kids, I'm going to eat, or I don't know, and people find that boring and they drop off, I'm not offended by it. I think that's fine. Follow the people that are of interest to you. And if someone is not adding value to what you're doing, don't follow them. It's okay. You can always check on them again. You can always refollow. I have people that regularly unfollow and refollow, and I just can't take it personally. It's just the way it is. I was talking about Python earlier today on Twitter, and I picked up 9 new people. Now, they're people that I have no idea who they are. They are interested in Python. And I guarantee as soon as I start talking about other stuff, they're going to go away. And that's okay.
Yeah, it's the same thing we're seeing in our voice chat rooms, that people equate that to personal relationships. And if I come in and see who's there and then leave, they'll all think I'm rude. And it's a different sphere, a different social climate that people have to get used to.
A lot of the rules don't apply. And socially, you wouldn't just turn around and walk out of a room if someone starts, you know, talking about something you don't want to talk about. I think of it like TV or radio, where by following someone, you're not saying, I really like this person, or I'm friends with this person. I hate the fact that Facebook calls people friends. Most of the people that are friends with me on Facebook, I'm not friends with them. I don't know who they are. I mean, I know their name. I might have talked to them, but if I were to move, this is how I look at this. If I were to move, how much of my Facebook friends would show up to help me? And I think people get hung up on that. These are my friends. No, they're not. It's just like in AOL Messenger, you have buddies. They're not buddies. They're just people I chat to. Maybe some of them are my buddies. They're not all my buddies. You can't be really misled by that. So with Twitter, when you have, and this is more powerful than friends, you have followers.
I'll just call them groupies.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I have all these Twitter groupies.
Now, what is this new game that's all the rage on Twitter that people are playing?
It's called Spy Master, and I was immediately impressed with it, and now it's driving me crazy. Essentially, you are a spy, and you can sign up with one of the 3 major world intelligence organizations, and you invite your Twitter friends to also join, and the more you can get to join, the stronger your spy ring gets, and then you start performing tasks. This is all web-based, by the way, and you can start collecting letter drops. You can start, you know, just doing different tasks. For each task, you get some money and you gain experience so that you can start buying weapons and you can buy armor and you can do all this stuff. And then you can attack other spy rings. It's kind of this espionage sort of game. It is a little bit fun. I admit I've invested a few hours in Spy Master. The annoying part comes with the fact that by default, it sends a tweet when you do everything. It's also customizable. There are checkboxes that say, send a tweet when I perform a task. Well, you know, you're going to perform about 200 tasks on each level, give or take. So I just uncheck that. Otherwise, people are going to go crazy. Send a tweet when I increase in level. Well, that might or might not be of interest to people. Spy Master's made a lot of enemies because people will sign up or have been signing up and leaving them all checked. And so all of a sudden, someone who's generally quiet on Twitter starts sending, you know, 15, 20 tweets an hour.
Are you putting your Twitter login information in there?
Yeah. When you log into Spy Master, your login credentials are your Twitter credentials. I really hate this about Twitter, that they use your Twitter username and password.
I'm always concerned with sharing those credentials with any third party.
I am too, and I think Twitter really needs to fix that. They've talked about it, and they sort of have a new solution to the problem, but it's not implemented everywhere, and a lot of people are just asking still for the username and password versus using this new thing that Twitter's invented. They're trying to be a little more Facebookish, where the service is trusted to Twitter, and then you tell Twitter, yes, I trust this person to act on my behalf or not, so that your password isn't exchanged to that other entity. But it hasn't really caught at this point, so a lot of people are just requiring the Twitter username and password, which, yeah, it's scary, because then they can tweet whatever you want. I remember that Twitterscope thing. I have always found it annoying. It just sends a daily horoscope out, is what it's supposed to do. At first, it was kind of cute, and then it was really annoying. And then I realized everyone was doing it, which made it even more annoying. Twitterscope, the problem was you really couldn't cancel it. One night, I couldn't sleep, and I happened to be online. It was around 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and I saw a tweet on my name that came over and said, to purchase high-quality rugs, visit, and then an address. I found that, in fact, Twitterscope was sending, at night, various advertising tweets.
Next thing you know, you'll be selling Viagra.
That's right, yeah. For Viagra, call Steve.
So how would someone employ your services? How does that work?
Well, they can call me up or visit the website. The webpage is www.atmaine, AT for assistive tech and Maine like the state, .com. Or you can just call 207-512-2387, 207-512-2387, and we can talk about what it is you might need. I try to do it task-oriented if I can. What I want people to know, especially individuals that I'm working with, is roughly how much is this going to cost? And also depends on the work. If I'm doing training, I try to do it pretty inexpensively at $25 per hour, billed in half-hour increments, and I charge more for more technical-type stuff.
And how does Serotech's Remote Incident Manager come into play in helping you perform these tasks?
It is a godsend. It's fantastic. I have Serotech System Access and the Remote Incident Manager, so that if you are a Serotech customer, I can help you through System Access if you already have that installed. And what I often try to do is remotely not control what you're doing, but watch what you're doing so that we can chat and you do the hands-on stuff. And then I kind of monitor what you're doing and say, you know, this is not correct or this is correct, or see what's going on, versus me just saying, okay, you just do this, 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 and this, and then you don't know what it is I did after the fact. And if you're not a Serotech customer or you're not using System Access, if for whatever reason it doesn't work with System Access, I have the RIM, and that's fantastic, because it works basically with anyone and is real easy to install. I help people get that up and running. We're not on the clock when I help someone get the communication stuff established, because it benefits me. We get you all set up and make sure we have audio connectivity through System Access or through Skype or through phone or however we're going to do the audio, and figure all those pieces out before we start the clock. That allows me to basically provide services to anywhere. I've worked with folks in Europe. I try to be really, really flexible. I've gotten up at 2 a.m. to work with people in Hawaii, because that was a good convenient time for them, and any other time. So as long as I know in advance, I can try to match whatever the schedule and time zone is.
Thanks a lot. Steve Salkson with AT Show and atmaine.com.
I guess it was back in February that I kind of had the idea about, okay, how do we create a universally accessible, speaking about browsers and OSs, because let's face it, Opera, as obscure as it may be, there's got to be one or two Opera users. There's got to be one or two skinny browser users. And then I found out just through a group, Google group, there's 540 Mac visionaries, and that's a pretty big group of people. How do we create a process where we use inherent tools, native tools within the OS, to transmit an image that can be used to solve CAPTCHA? The first name it had was Image Interpreter. Showed it to a couple of people out in Louisville, Kentucky at the American Printing House for the Blind, and did some pretty, you know, rudimentary testing with it. No users, no logging in, just upload an image and wait for a result kind of deal. And really matured it from there with user input from a lot of people to whom I'm very grateful and have given credit on the website.
The process is very, very simple. I mean, just upload the screenshot and then it gets recognized and the user gets the CAPTCHA back. What happens, though, when you're asleep? I guess at the moment you're the only operator. Is that true? Or?
Well, I'll have to admit I am the only operator right now. To expand on that a little bit, within the last 3 days, I signed up a volunteer to whom I'm very thankful in London, England. And the time zone difference will be very important and very meaningful, because I'm in GMT minus 6. He's in GMT 0, I believe, maybe minus 1. So the spread of time will really make it a lot easier. Basically, I just have a really elaborate notification system. And so I know when an image is being uploaded. I know when it's uploaded and ready for me to retrieve. But I just wake up whenever one comes in and go back to sleep.
Now, are you looking for volunteers at this point, or are you just trying to start slowly?
Absolutely. And one of the challenges I've had, and I would certainly welcome your feedback as a member of the community or input, I'm very hesitant to simply put a post or a message. I want to be really selective, because we're dealing with basically screen captures of people's computers. The system is very anonymous, and, you know, I really try to disclose within the instructions on Celona how to proactively protect yourself. In other words, like I'm looking at a screen right now that a CAPTCHA just came through from a Safari user, Apple user, to join Twitter. It's blank. I see a full name field. I see a username field. They're empty. I have no idea who this person is. I don't know their username on Celona. It's in a database, but I don't see it as an operator. All I see literally is the Twitter screen, and I see the browser window and the CAPTCHA. And so I'm able to return the CAPTCHA code in ASCII text to whomever submitted it. It is literally the best way to ensure anonymity to the maximum degree possible. And that's really paramount to me. Before Celona had a name, I spent a lot of time perusing lists, Blind AD being one of them. I perused a lot of blogs and sought out members of the community to get opinions. What was important? What were the faults? I saw where people tried to charge for this, and that to me is not only a huge mistake, I think it's just misguided that this should not be something for which a person has to pay. And so that is dear to my heart. And it's also one of the reasons that unless there's some public input, I personally won't develop an IE plugin or toolbar. And it's too expensive. The expenses I have related to Celona, I can share with some other projects I do, so it's not 100% expense. But back to your volunteer question, that was sort of a tangent. The first volunteer who signed up is a brother of a Celona user. The first thing I did was I said, well, who's your brother? Found his username, found his website. I went to a member of the steering committee on Celona and said, hey, have you heard of this guy? Good reputation. Those sort of simple organic tests, I think, are pretty effective. And as long as a person has a good rap, then you bet. I would love to sign on people as volunteers. They don't have to install a lot of software. They can volunteer whenever they want. If they can't solve a CAPTCHA, it just goes to the next person, and maybe even to me at that point. So I really am excited about having some volunteers in different time zones sign up. I did sign someone up in Eastern Standard Time in Atlanta, Georgia, and she's my sister-in-law. And so I kind of vouch for her as a person of good integrity, a person who will examine the CAPTCHAs when they come in and as accurately as possible return the code.
The other, I think, important thing is you don't have to be a technical genius to do this either, right? I mean, someone, as long as they can recognize the CAPTCHA, not a huge learning curve to figure out the system is there for either the operators or for users.
That's a very good point. From the operator perspective, there's just a small software that they'll have to install, which is basically the notification system. And they receive a link to the CAPTCHA, which is presented in a native browser. They can use IE, they can use Opera, they can use Firefox, they can use Safari. It's very interoperable from that perspective. All they see is a CAPTCHA and a box. They see one at a time, they click enter, and they don't know where that CAPTCHA text goes. It could be anywhere. Could be the house next door, could be 4,000 miles away.
And I think your commitment to privacy and how you do describe in the docs that, it's a good idea not to fill the form in ahead of time and that sort of stuff, really to kind of ensure that the system remains private is paramount, because it's always been a big concern of mine with any of these CAPTCHA systems. How much of the data do they get? What's being disclosed and to whom? Who actually has access to this? I think it's amazing that you're looking at this and really are focusing on that piece of it. What put you on this track? Something must have motivated you to say, geez, we need to solve this problem. This is a problem that's only getting worse, and we need some sort of solution.
My vision came out of seeing how blind and visually impaired users navigated sites with captions. I think that it's really difficult, and I can tell you in the hundreds that I've processed since the loan has been live and kind of organically been spread through user groups and mailing lists, what have you. Most that come through are not recapture. Most that come through are homegrown, no-charge visual verification systems that do not have audio alternatives. And I think that until bodies like W3C get involved and say, if you want your site to be certified W3C, for example, you have to have audio. That's sort of a whole nother tangent that I could go into and talk about the lack of addressing that on their side, if you will. But that's really why I got into it. And like I said, it took about 10 weeks between going back and forth with certain users, getting feedback and logistics and what works and what doesn't. And, one of the big issues we had to figure out was what quality image do we have to capture so that it, number one, is uploaded fast and can be downloaded fast and not difficult to handle on the user's computer. You have to be a native format. So we chose Bitmap. Bitmap seems to work really well, and I think a lot of users have benefited from it. They get a lot of Google registrations, get a lot of Yahoo registrations, get a lot of Twitter registrations. You might be interested to know, and I've mentioned this in a couple different places, Solana has really taken off in the Spanish community. They have translated the instructions. I have worked one-on-one with some Yahoo group administrators from Yahoo.es, which is the Yahoo Spain version, if you will. Currently, Solana is only in English. So there are Google groups, or Yahoo groups, rather, that have the instructions elaborately described in Spanish. And I think that's great.
I love the fact that the community just gets involved, that this is being propagated through word of mouth. I mean, it's very grassroots in a way, and super effective.
It really is, and something else that is very important to me and I'm trying to promote is a steering committee within Solana that's made up of members of the blind, visually impaired community. And the steering committee is really a group of people with whom I can talk about the back-end issues, what I see, what's wrong, abuse, if there's any, how do we solve this common problem, ways to improve.
You know, one thing you mentioned earlier is that the expenses at this point are minimal because you're able to share with some other projects you're doing. But I wonder if one huge source of revenue could be some of these sites themselves that aren't accessible due to their CAPTCHA. Not that you want to do their dirty work for them, but in some respect, you've solved a huge problem. And I mean, why shouldn't Google or Twitter or any of these sites pay for a service that in some respect you're really providing them?
Well, I think for that to happen, Solana would have to be more mature. Solana right now is not incorporated. It is not registered at the state level or national level. It's not a 501c3. It doesn't even have a bank account. And so I think if I were to approach, and actually I can comment on a company I did approach in a minute, but I think I would have to be much more formal and probably have, you know, a very well-grown steering committee and some board members to be able to approach, you know, Fortune 500 companies and certainly that stature. I can tell you that as a trend, it's going the wrong direction as far as accessibility. CAPTCHA is going way multimedia. It's going way visual. It's connect the dots, look for the helicopter here, and then look in the bank of 9 images and find the helicopter kind of example. It's funny because Asura, I have an article I'm working on right now about Asura. They openly say it's not accessible, and they don't plan to make it. They don't even dance around it. They just say, this is designed for human interaction, visual interaction, that there will not be an audio version. There's another one that follows me on Twitter that is similar to Asura. I contacted them. They sent me a canned response, and I'm going to give them a second chance before I write an article that blasts it. Because every time a company comes out with an intentional visual verification with no plans for audio or, let's face it, accessibility for visually impaired. Having said that, it also affects cognitive problems. People with dyslexia have just as much problems with visual verification as visually impaired people. The more that just intentionally do it, it just creates ideas for other companies to do it. I wrote about a social networking site called Unity, which is felt kind of funny, and it's on the blog if anyone wants to look at it. They wrote their own little CAPTCHA deal, and they're proud of it. No mention of accessibility, no mention of even click here if you're visually impaired so we can help you sign up. The only site that I've seen that does that is Wikipedia, and I have not tested it. They have a pretty active statement on their sign-up page that says, we understand this is not accessible, and we will not try and dance around it, but if you can't sign up, here's a contact form to use, and we will process your request.
I think AOL does that as well. At least they used to have a link. If you couldn't sign up for an AOL screen name, you could click it, fill in your information, and someone would call you back at some point. That was the big problem. Eventually, yeah, they might call you back. I mean, it might be 5 minutes, it might be a day, but at some point, someone would call you back, and as long as you weren't in a hurry, I suppose it's a solution. Forums are another big thing. I mean, everything online now uses a forum, and before you can post, you have to create an account. Blog posts, often you need to create accounts or fill in a CAPTCHA just to reply to it. I mean, this CAPTCHA stuff has just grown unbelievably. It's everywhere.
I know that the website owners and administrators, their complaints are valid. There are people who literally have too much time on their hands, and they sit around and think of ways to make 1,000 accounts on Google and then sell them. They sit around and think of ways to make 1,000 accounts on Demonoid and then sell them. And they have their little chart. It's like they're playing Duke Nukem, how many sites they can abuse. I try to point out those articles, too. I try to point out the aggressiveness of groups to hack CAPTCHAs and create thousands of accounts illegitimately. It really is a challenge, and I think that the first CAPTCHA was presented in 2001, so we're 8 years into it. ReCAPTCHA is the best thing currently for audio CAPTCHA, and I plan to have a portion of Salona dedicated to helping people get better at ReCAPTCHA, because I have spent time with my eyes covered using ReCAPTCHA, trying to figure out, okay, how can I use this more effectively, listening to these distorted phrases, and I have become able to do that. I want to share with the community the steps a person can take to effectively solve a ReCAPTCHA audio version.
Well, the other problem with ReCAPTCHA is it's assumed, I think, that the person can hear fine, and if the person has any sort of hearing impairment in addition to a visual impairment, then they're not going to hear those jumbled phrases correctly, or they're not going to understand some of those letters or numbers which kind of mix into the background and become unintelligible. That's a pretty large population.
You're right. That is something I've tried to address also in articles about sites that have audio CAPTCHA or don't have audio CAPTCHA. My opinion on that is it's really something that is just going to have to be worked out in a capitalist way. In other words, not from a money-making perspective, but from creativity. And projects like Salona, certainly WebVision, fills a great void. When I first heard about WebVision, I thought, that's pretty neat. I mean, if you use Firefox and Windows, you can just click a button and follow the CAPTCHA. How they do it, I have no idea. I've never used WebVision. I probably would not sign up since I don't have a need for it. And I don't want to use a resource that can be used by somebody else who needs it.
My concern with it, and I'm using a Mac, so besides the fact that I can't use WebVision, and perhaps this is a bit over-paranoid, but I don't know what happens behind the scenes. And I think that's one of the things I really like about Salona is that it's very open. It's very clear. You know, you submit the image and this is where it's going to go. A human's going to see it. You know, you spell out, don't put stuff in there that you don't want to be in there, like your personal information on a form. And, you know, there's no question mark about, you know, what happens to this data? Where is it going? What is the process? With WebVision, which works great, it's kind of a mystery. You hit the key and at some point you get the result, and where that data goes and what happens to it and how it's processed and so forth is just kind of a mystery. I'm glad the project exists. It certainly benefits a lot of folks. I admit that I'm probably over paranoid, but it just seems very vague, and probably it's purposefully done that way. I think that can be a problem.
It's just an approach. I mean, I have chosen to address Salona in a public forum very openly with names, locations, goals, standards, procedures. I talk a lot to people one-on-one via email and sometimes instant messenger. I won't solve a CAPTCHA that way, but if the user has a question or it just seems to work out better that we, you know, talk one-on-one and work through something, I'm more than happy to do that. But like you said, I you know, basically Salona is very in the open, and it is also a personal objective of mine to include people from the visually impaired community in the project, not as users, but as leaders. Here's a steering committee. This is made up of people who use Salona. And so it's not just a guy sitting in Dallas, Texas at a keyboard once in a while deciding what happened. It has input from people who use the service. I try to be very accessible. I try to be in the forefront. There's no reason to hide behind a monitor. It's important to me that people have confidence in the project, that they can associate a name, a voice, a profile with the project. That's something I try and keep in the forefront every time I work with Salona, which is every day.
I'm also very impressed that you're maintaining a blog, though, in addition to Salona, a blog that's very informative and provides a lot of resources about some of these CAPTCHA systems, which I think is a fantastic resource, but can also serve as a way to kind of bring awareness to this issue, because CAPTCHA is sort of something that people don't know anything about. They're just frustrated by it, but they don't understand it, why it exists, that there's different types, anything like that. And your blog really goes a long way to addressing that in specifics.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I think I've written 25 or 26 articles, and I try to balance it between sites that, a good site to me is one that has no CAPTCHA and is a really big time site, like Oprah. I wrote about Oprah. Oprah is just kind of like milk and butter. I mean, it's something everybody knows, TV, radio, commercials, print, you know, everything. So when I went to Oprah and signed up and realized there was no CAPTCHA, I used JAWS through the entire registration. I thought, this is great. I need to bring attention to the good, just like I need to bring attention to the not so good.
Right.
One other success story that I will share with you And I did mention it in Twitter, complimenting the site owner, was a site called eZine Articles. eZine Articles is an Alexa Top 100, which to me is a big deal because, let's face it, there's got to be hundreds of millions of URLs or domain names. Maybe they're parked, maybe they're not, but there's a lot. So if they're in the top 100, that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And I worked with their registration and their contact form, and it was tricky. So I called some people who I mentioned in the article, who I would consider master users. They know a lot about JAWS. They know a lot about virtual cursors. And if they can do it, that's one thing. If they can't, we got a problem. And they couldn't. So I wrote an article that I thought was respectful of the company. And within a day, they were following me on Twitter and announced in a reply on the blog that they would fix it. And sure enough, in about 48 hours, they had it fixed. And I just thought that was the neatest example of advocacy and effectiveness for getting something fixed.
And I think that's what you're helping to do, is just really, you know, raise awareness and get that advocacy ball rolling, get people involved and that sort of thing. One of the big things I hear from developers is we don't know what to do. We need to have a CAPTCHA because we get too much spam and we have whatever. And you mentioned earlier that, you know, there is a place for CAPTCHA and so forth. There's not many resources, at least that I found, that really are geared toward developers to say, this is a better way, or this is a more accessible way to do something. If a developer can creatively figure it out, that's great. But I think it'd be fair to say many of them don't know how, don't have those resources.
That's a very good point. You know, in the arena of CAPTCHA developers, it's a lot of homegrown stuff. There's a lot of, you've got reCAPTCHA. And there's something I wanted to mention about reCAPTCHA that may be well-known, may not be well-known. It is accessible from the audio perspective. However, the audio is only in English.
That's true, yeah.
And that means that, you know, it may sound different to you and I who speak English as a primary language, but if I'm in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and I speak Portuguese, and I hear an English CAPTCHA phrase, it is going to be really, really tricky in the best of circumstances to not only, you know, put it into print, but accurately spell it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, if a person was lucky enough to be bilingual with English as a second language, they'd have a better chance. But I can tell you that when I look at a CAPTCHA, sometimes I have to refresh it because I can't tell what it says. Sometimes if I'm listening to a CAPTCHA, I have to refresh it because, you know, that one just didn't sound clear enough. And what I've always learned is you can hit refresh 5 times. Wait for one that looks good or wait for one that sounds good. And chances are you can solve it in reCAPTCHA. On the alternative tools, they are mainly small shops and they're free. Whenever it's free, it's not likely to get as much development.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these tools are built to be plugins with WordPress or Drupal or, of course, Blogger is hosted. So that's a moot point with Google. You know, forum like PunBB or PHBB or what other forum site. And I've got some of those that I'm getting ready to write about because they are huge sites that collect advertising revenue.
Yeah.
So that means they have money to devote toward implementing a more accessible CAPTCHA. But they don't. They stick with these other ones that are completely inaccessible. But the point of that is, you know, what they think is of successful CAPTCHA implementation is, well, the owner of the site can determine, is it 4 characters or 8 characters? Do you want background color or no background color? Do you want waves? Do you want lines? They put so much focus on the accessories that go into making a visual CAPTCHA, but nothing that goes into making it accessible. So it really is just, I think, a lack of awareness. And like you pointed out a moment ago, a lack of resources for a developer, and I think it's just going to take time. I think also that the ultimate accessible CAPTCHA will probably come from somewhere that we didn't expect it. I think it will come from creativity, from teamwork, from collaboration. And also, I will be very honest, I think it is really sad that reCAPTCHA, if they have an advisory board or a development board, do they have any visually impaired people on it? Do they have any hearing impaired people on it? Do they include members of the screen reader community in their development process? that's the greatest resource.
I'm amazed they haven't been compelled in any way to create an accessible alternative for their system. That's, I mean, given how many government entities and so forth implement reCAPTCHA and some of these other major systems, and yet I've never heard of a case coming forward where they've been compelled to make anything accessible.
Well, I think it goes back to W3C hasn't even written an article about CAPTCHA since 2003, I think, maybe 05. They have completely tabled it, which is just terrible. There's no excuse for it. reCAPTCHA is an interesting case because they sort of serve a social purpose, and it's explained on their website. They basically have images of books, and so millions of pages are scanned, but they're not OCR'd properly. And so what they do is they pull a word or two words out of those pages and put them on a screen for a user to tell reCAPTCHA what it is. Then they take the ASCII text and put it back in its place. So every day they're getting millions and millions of words accurately put back into books that would have taken a long time to make correct. They're basically building an online repository of OCR'd books. And since OCR is an imperfect technology, they use Humanize in the form of CAPTCHA solutions to tell reCAPTCHA, well, what do you see? Because the computer couldn't figure it out. And so I think since they're serving sort of a social cause, if you will, in this book translation project, there's probably less pressure because they're seen as doing something good, and so there's less pressure to look at the accessibility side.
Where are all these books going? Any idea?
The reCAPTCHA site does address this. They have a visual breakout and flowchart and interesting text about it. I can't tell you where the books go. Is it like the Google Books Project? Maybe Carnegie Mellon University has amassed high-volume scanners and scanned books that are out of circulation. Maybe they're in the public domain. I know that their project is to say, okay, page 17 out of this book did not get OCR'd well, so it's going to be put into the queue for reCAPTCHA processing. I think they suggest that maybe 30 million CAPTCHAs are solved a day, and on the high side, it could be 60 million words, because most CAPTCHAs are now two words.
For folks that want more information, they can go to your site, www.solona.net, correct?
Solona is an interesting name. I took a long time when trying to find the name. I used anagrams. I used Wikipedia ancient city lists and river lists. You know, I went down the road of, do I make it a four-letter domain name so it's short, or do I make it something meaningful? I didn't want the word CAPTCHA in it. I didn't want it to be, you know, solvethiscaptcha.org. I wanted a name that could be pronounced in multiple languages easily. And Solona accomplishes that. What I found was so many .coms were taken that I had to settle for .net or .org. Solona is what I chose. That's the brand I'm building.
Is there any other way that people listening might be able to help or contribute?
You know what would be really neat, Steve, is if someone listening or who's aware of Solona has experience in perhaps interviewing volunteers. That's going to be an issue, because I think it's important that when someone expresses an interest, that someone talks to them, someone communicates with them. We just want to make sure that the people we're employing to do this are of integrity. And so there's going to be a need to talk to people who want to be volunteers. Pass the litmus test, if you will. If someone has experience in that and would be interested to step forward, I would be most appreciative. I think the point you brought up about balancing advocacy with a practical solution is a point very well made, because it is important to balance the two. It's one to solve the CAPTCHAs, but also we need to raise awareness. Something that kind of an ironic goal of mine, Solona should not be a permanent solution. And the reason it shouldn't be permanent is there should be an accessible CAPTCHA. So my goal is that there's an accessible CAPTCHA implemented and sites catch on to it, and then Solona shouldn't be needed. It should be able to go away. Until that happens, I'm more than happy to continue maintaining Solona and promoting it and managing it.
How can people contact you? Is there contact info on the webpage or email address?
There's two forms on the webpage for registered users. If you're authenticated to Solona, you can just click contact support in the user section. And basically, if you do that, we know automatically who is sending the message, because we match who you're logged in as with the message coming back to me. If you're a visitor to the site and want to contact me, there's a contact form accessible from the front page, and you just have to leave your name and email and whatever message. Or my email address, I use Gmail because it's easy, is just mysolona@gmail.com. I do Twitter actively on Twitter under the username Solona, S-O-L-O-N-A.
And the website, of course, is www.solona.net. Thanks so much for speaking with us. Definitely appreciate it. It's truly an honor.
My pleasure. Thank you for your time, Steve.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB-2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.